One of the most vivid warnings of potential conflict came last Thursday from Secretary General of NATO, Mark Rutte, former Prime Minister of the Netherlands. He said we need to prepare for the scale of war faced by our grandparents. Now, since he took up his post at NATO just over a year ago, Mr. Rutte has had a busy time. Russia, Ukraine, Trump, Europe. A lot is going on. But he spent 15 minutes today to talk to PM about the security of the West. We're going to play you most of that. We put it into two chunks. Later, we'll hear what he has to say about the US and Europe. But let's start with Russian aggression. I asked him whether a peace deal for Ukraine is likely or possible by Christmas.
It's difficult to predict. What I know is that the Americans, the Europeans, Ukraine are working day and night to get it done. Obviously, you also need the Russians. But when it comes to the Europeans and Ukrainians and Americans, they are absolutely focused on this and working very hard, for example, on the security guarantee issue. So I can only commend everybody under President Trump's leadership trying to get this done.
Are you worried that a peace deal on the kind of terms that are being talked about will leave Russia more confident that the will isn't there to stop it? It'll make it more confident that it can engage in other activities in Ukraine or beyond Ukraine in future?
I don't, because I know what is being discussed at the moment. And part of that is a set of security guarantees consisting, of course, of the Ukrainian armed forces, the coalition of the winning led by the Brits and the French and the Germans at the moment, as you know. And then the U.S. involvement in that, because the American president clearly stated in August that he wants to be involved in those security guarantees. All of this is now being hammered out and nailed, making sure that we know exactly what we mean. To an extent that Russia will see that with these security guarantees in place, he should never, ever try again to attack Ukraine, because our reaction will be devastating. And that's exactly what we are now discussing. So no, I'm not worried that that will happen.
Okay. Now, look, last week you did issue a warning, and I want to know why you spelled it out in such stark terms. You said we need to prepare for wars on the scale that our grandparents and great-grandparents fought, i.e., First World War, Second World War. We need to prepare for that kind of conflict. Why did you feel it necessary to give that kind of warning?
Because there is one way to prevent that. And the only way to prevent that is by doing two things. One is to implement what we decided this year. And in The Hague, at the NATO summit, we decided all of us to spend 5% on defense, including the 3.5% on core defense, not later than 2035, to ramp up defense spending. But we also decided another thing, and that is the second issue we have to focus on, and that is to keep Ukraine as strong as possible. Because if Ukraine loses, if Russia would get access to the whole of Ukraine, it would basically mean that the 3.5% core defense spending, 5% overall, is not nearly enough. It will be much more. So to prevent that from spending even more than we already committed to, we have to keep Ukraine strong. And we have to deliver on what we committed to deliver in The Hague. And that is really, really crucial. If we don't, indeed, there is this big risk that the Russians might try to attack us. Now we are stronger. But if we do not implement the Hague decisions, we would be weaker than the Russians in a couple of years. And that is extremely dangerous.
Let's dig into this a bit, because I wonder if you could. I mean, many people think you've overstated the threat from Russia, or misstated the threat. Can you give me a scenario? Give me a scenario, not necessarily a likely one or the most likely, but some kind of scenario in which Russia takes on, I don't know, a NATO member or moves beyond Ukraine, in which Russia actually poses a threat to to Western Europe.
I'll give you a few facts, and then I'll give you the scenario. First, the facts. The Russians are now spending 40% of their state budget on defense, 10% of their whole economy. They have been willing, till this moment, in the war in Ukraine, since the full-scale invasion started in February 2022, to lose 1.1 million of their own people. They are now losing 25,000 Russians a month, killed in Ukraine, with only very incremental successes when it comes to the front line. Under 1% of Ukrainian territory gained this year by the Russians, so very incremental successes. 25,000 people lost. You have seen over the last couple of months the increasingly reckless behavior by the Russians when it comes to the drones in Poland, the MiG-31s in Estonia, and so many other examples of the hybrid activities the Russians are willing to undertake. So these are the facts. And you don't. So we have to deal with a country where the dictator is willing to lose 1.1 million of his own people because of some historical idea that he wants to regain power over the whole of Ukraine, or at least big parts of Ukraine. And now the scenario could be this one, that if China would move against Taiwan, and that risk is there. The Chinese are massively investing in their own defense, a much bigger economy than the Russian economy, with so many more people. There is a junior partner in all of this, because they work closely together with the Russians being the junior partner. There is no doubt in my mind, and in many in the policy and defense circles in NATO, that Xi Jinping will force his junior partner, Vladimir Putin, to keep us busy here. So that could be a scenario.
Okay, so I see that. I mean, some of those who think you overstated it say, look, Russia's, for the reasons you've just described, Russia has lost so much to make small gains in Ukraine. The idea that they would invade Lithuania, the Baltics, or move into Western Europe is preposterous. There are a lot of issues around President Putin, but he's not insane in that way, and he would never do that.
Well, how insane can you be to kill or get seriously wounded 1.1 million of your own people just because you have this historical idea that you want to regain access to Ukraine? He has stated before that he wants to recapture the territory of the old Soviet Union. He wants to reestablish the influence over large parts of Europe. I mean, it's all there, so let's not be naive. Absolutely not be naive. Let's make sure that we are, yes, stronger today, that we keep on being stronger in the future. Because there is one thing you can be sure of with this man and this leadership in Russia, that if we are not strong and not posing a credible deterrent, that he will try. And that's why we cannot take the risk. We cannot take the risk of not making these investments in our military, in our military industry, defense industry, getting more people active in our armed forces, men and women in uniform. We cannot take that risk.
Now, we heard from NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte earlier on the Russian threat, how that could materialize. But apart from Russia, of course, European leaders worry about their key ally, the US. Whether the Trump administration is as committed as it used to be to the democratic liberal worldview and the transatlantic alliance. So let us return to Mark Rutte now, the second section of the interview he gave PM today. I asked him whether he was concerned about some of the phrases in that US national security strategy, saying Europe is facing civilizational erasure and that the US should cultivate resistance in Europe.
What I have been doing is looking at the parts in the national security strategy having to do with the collective defense. And there are some very strong statements, very positive statements. One, complete commitment of the U.S. to European security, a complete commitment of the U.S. to NATO, a complete commitment to keeping that relationship, U.S., Europe, NATO, as strong as possible. I can assure you why that is. That is because the U.S. realizes that for the U.S. to stay safe in the future, they need three things. A secure Europe, a secure Arctic, because the Arctic is even closer to home than Europe. And the Arctic is, with the Russians and the Chinese being active there, if that is not secured, it's a direct threat to the U.S. mainland and homeland. And the same is when it comes to the Northern Atlantic. The ocean, a secure North Atlantic, is crucial for a safe and secure America. And the only way to keep the Northern Atlantic secure and safe is collective in NATO with 32 nations working together. So there is that clear common interest here. And there was only one big irritant on the American side with NATO, the European and Canadian part of NATO, that we were not spending the same as they were spending. This is since Eisenhower. And Trump has been extremely, President Trump from his first term in office and also his second term in office, has been extremely clear. And his biggest foreign policy success, I believe, when it comes to all of this, has been the NATO summit in The Hague, collectively, all of us committing to the 5% defense spending.
committing to it, yeah. I mean, one of the debates in Europe is how you react to Trump, and you'll know this. And there are really, aren't there two sides? One is you just have to flatter the guy to keep them as involved as you possibly can keep them. And the other is maybe someone should just push back against this kind of stuff and say, no, there isn't civilizational erasure in Europe. Don't be stupid. And we don't want you to be interfering our politics. I mean, you're on the side, I think I'm right in saying, of keep flattering the guy in order to keep him on board, yeah?
Why is it so difficult to tell somebody that he is doing good stuff when he is doing good stuff? I believe fundamentally that thanks to Donald J. Trump, NATO is stronger than it ever was. That thanks to Donald J. Trump, we have now a situation where the US and Europe and Ukraine are working closely together to get this terrible war in Ukraine, this Russian war of aggression, ended. We are working together to make sure that we are as strong as possible against Russia, working together with China, North Korea and Iran in the future. This is thanks to Donald J. Trump and, of course, the collective European and Canadian leadership taking that lead and following and then taking the necessary decisions in The Hague. That's not flattery. That is stating the facts. And if these facts are there, yes, I think we should be thankful of the people who do that.
I love the fact you focus on the positive. Absolutely a good thing for someone in your position to do. But have we ever had a situation in NATO where one member happens to be the most important member, literally talks about cultivating resistance in other member states, interfering in internal affairs? Can you ever think of a case of that occurring in NATO's history?
Again, I'm focusing on the parts of the national security strategy pertaining to the collective defense, okay. And they are as strong as they need to be. There is a total commitment of the U.S. to NATO, to Europe. There were all these discussions over last year. Is the U.S. leaving us? They are not. They had one expectation, spending more. Take Germany. Germany will spend by 2029 close to 100 billion more on its defense than they did in 2021. Europe is now paying for the weapons being delivered to Ukraine from the U.S. This is Europe stepping up. The coalitions are winning, led by Keir Starmer and Emmanuel Macron and Friedrich Merz. It is Europe stepping up. The collective defense of the eastern flank of NATO and the Baltic, our two sentry missions there, it is European dominated. It is Europe stepping up. This is exactly what the U.S. expected, and rightly so. And the U.S. has said we will stay committed to Europe, both in the conventional military sense, as of course through the nuclear umbrella, as we have always been doing.
A lot of Europeans do regard this as a kind of a life-changing moment in the history of NATO, and that Europe does have to step up, and that Trump isn't a temporary phenomenon. I mean, there is obviously a temptation to say, let's just wait for the next president who may be a little nicer in his words about Europe, that Europe essentially now not has to go it alone, but needs to take responsibility. Do you at least see this as a kind of once-in-a-lifetime reorientation of what the Western alliance means, of what the West means as a concept?
Can I ask you a question? Would you ever think that countries like Belgium and Spain and Italy, who were spending only 1.5, 1.4, 1.6% of defense, would all reach the 2% by the end of 2025, as they have committed to do? Would you ever have expected that in a NATO summit, 32 nations coming together would agree that for the collective defense of the 1 billion people living in NATO territory, we had to spend 5% on defense? Yeah. This would never have happened if Donald J. Trump had not been elected as president of the United States.
Agreed.
And I'm fundamentally convinced of this. I am looking at the defense of 1 billion people, and I think Donald J. Trump is good news for that collective defense and for NATO and for Ukraine.
But, you know, I think they perhaps agreed to spend more, and we should debate whether they are spending much more, but they've agreed to spend more precisely because they no longer feel sure that that American guarantee of European security is there. And you can't rely on voters in Wisconsin for the defense of Latvia. And in the end, Europe just has to face it. It is responsible for the defense against, particularly against Russia in this continent.
But here you are only half right. You are half right in the sense that, yes, Europe has to step up. That's completely logical, and there I agree with you. But you are also half wrong, because in the end, NATO as a collective defensive alliance, against Russia and any other threat there might be on this world. Look what China is doing in the build-up of its military. Look at Iran, North Korea, they're all working together. It is also in the US interest, and sometimes we tend to forget that in Europe, to keep the United States safe. You need a safe Arctic and a secure Atlantic and a secure Europe. And for that, you need this collective alliance. And the United States, they realize this. So we don't have to be worried that the US is leaving us because it is not in their interest.
Okay, one last question. I want you to think ahead 15 years. Trump will be gone. Putin, one assumes, will be gone. What will NATO look like then? How will the world be different? What preparation should we be making for 2040 and how the world will look?
I would argue that at this moment, this Christmas time 2025, NATO has never been as strong as this moment since the fall of the Berlin Wall. In 15 years, what we will have done is build on that success of 2025, that is implementing all the decisions we made in The Hague. We will have done everything, but also here we need the Russians also to play ball, eh? And otherwise we have to increase the pressure on Russia. But let's see where the peace process comes to the next couple of weeks. But in 15 years, we will have done everything to make sure that Ukraine is a sovereign nation, able to defend itself against the Russians with clear security guarantees in place if the Russians would try again. And therefore, they will not try again. There will be sufficient deterrence. That is the situation. And that means that collectively, 1 billion people will be able to defend our way of life. The United States, Canada, we here in Europe, which is our free societies with elections, with our free press, like the BBC and all the other great institutions of our free media in Europe, the US and Canada. And that makes us so much stronger longer term than any other country on earth which doesn't have these attributes like free democracy, free press, and the right to express yourself and choose the way you want to live your own life. It's worth defending, and that's where we spend more. We will do that. In 50 years, we are even stronger than we are today.